Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And this afternoon, we're very privileged to have two filmmakers, artists. One is Margaret Honda, a visual artist who lives and works in Los Angeles, who's had one-person exhibitions at the Drawing Center, New York, and the Museum of Contemporary Art, Los Angeles. And last night, her film premiered, did it?
UK premiere
of Spectrum Reverse Spectrum was shown as part of the London Film Festival. And she's accompanied by Morgan Fisher, a distinguished conceptual filmmaker, artist, exhibited at Raven Row recently, and represented, I think, this year in Frieze by the Maureen Paley Gallery, one picture. But you've been making films since about 1968, and we could possibly, perhaps we'll move on to that later, but Margaret, perhaps we could discuss your film first of all, which was Spectrum Reverse Spectrum, intriguing film, 21 minutes long. We saw it last night at the film festival. Completely, is it fair to say it was monochrome, or because it changes colour throughout, I suppose it's multichrome?
That's a good question. Uh-huh. I think what you see at any one moment on the screen you could describe as a monochrome, but the colours are constantly changing, and they're changing very gradually so that you don't notice the shift from, say, yellow to orange.
Right.
It's very gradual. Multichrome could probably work as well.
So does it ever, is it ever the same color for two frames? Is it constantly changing, or is it a sort of, does it hold color for periods of time?
It's pretty much constantly changing, and also there are no frames in the film. It was made on 70 millimeter print stock directly in a contact printer without a negative from a color timing tape. And so there are, because there was no negative involved, there are no frame lines. So you can actually hold the film up to the light and see various colors, and perhaps within a certain part of the film, say a certain, you know, 2 or 3 millimeters, it would look essentially the same.
Right.
But it's basically always in the process of changing and not necessarily holding on any one particular color.
It's quite extraordinary to be in 70 millimeter for such a film, isn't it? I mean, that's such a, it must be, I mean, it's unusual for, say, an avant-garde filmmaker to adopt such a large format.
I think it's probably unusual for most people
yes,
who work
well,
with
I suppose
film.
So.
I think especially in avant-garde filmmaking, I don't know of a whole lot of other people who've worked. I believe that Stan Brakhage made an IMAX film, which I have not seen.
Okay.
And I don't know if he ever screened it in 70 millimeter or not. My understanding is that it was transferred to 35, but I don't quote me on that.
And is it totally obsolete format now? Or?
It's not totally obsolete. As with all film formats, it's heading in that direction, unfortunately. But you can still get 70 millimeter print stock, and there are a number of big Hollywood directors who choose to shoot on 65 millimeter negative. I think a number of them would actually like to have the film screened as 70 millimeter prints, but for economic reasons, most films of that nature would be distributed digitally.
And my
film is never going to go to digital.
So. No. Well, that was going to be my next question about why produce such a... I mean, the difficulties of presenting such a film must be enormous. It must have a very limited distribution, I would imagine, if at all.
It does, and that was part of my thinking when I started making this film.
Uh-huh.
I was very interested in this idea that the widest gauge in use, 70 millimeter, is something that is I mean, it's the biggest image. It's, it has the highest, you know, resolution. It's a beautiful projection if it's done right. And yet it's becoming almost invisible to, you know, 70 millimeter prints. It's very hard to find projectors. And I was thinking that I was also interested not just in the material itself, but in the sort of ecology that surrounds how it gets seen. You have to have the labs, you have to have the materials, you have to have people who know how to operate the machinery, the printers, for example, and the projectors. You have to have projectors that are in good order, that have are properly maintained with the, you know, lamp house mirrors, well adjusted, and I'm discovering more and more things every day. There's, you also have to have an appropriate screen as well. A lot of screens now are being made for digital projections and also 3D projections, where you get they're very reflective, and for a monochrome film such as mine, a solid color field, it doesn't really work that way.
But all of this sounds like it's making life incredibly difficult in terms of actually how you handle this film, what you do with it. It is as though you've created obstacles for the film. Well, no, you haven't created them, but you've chosen a very difficult road, shall we say.
I think that I wasn't, I'm not... you know, I'm not a masochist. I think I really would like the film to be seen, but I also know that I want it to be seen properly. I want it to be screened in a theater. I want it to be projected as film, and it's not like an image that can be viewed on across various platforms. You know, it's a film, it's an object, it was made, it was constructed sort of as a palindrome, so you can start the film at either end and it's exactly the same film. And so it operates really, it's, I wanted it to have its strengths as an object as well as something that you see on the screen. And I think, given those ideas, yes, you know, I did choose something that was going to be a little bit difficult in terms of distribution, but it's not my objective to make it easy. I mean, it's not my objective to make it difficult, but you know, it's not really a choice to say, well, I just want to make it easy for everybody to see it. You know, I really want it to be seen in a certain way.
It did have a very extremely sort of a calming aura about it. I mean, the presentation, sort of as one relaxed into viewing the film, it seems almost, in comparison to other films, it's almost sort of therapeutic. I mean, is that an intention, or would that be a sort of...
I think it's a nice sort of... side effect, shall we say.
But that's not your intention.
When I began making the film, I really was focusing on the production itself, the methodology of production, the fact that I wasn't going to use a camera, that I was working directly with the lab, and we had to make certain decisions on... you know, how to work with the printer, how to make it work most effectively. So there were certain, those were the things that I was really focused on at first, and I hadn't really thought about making a film that would have a certain effect on people. That was that was a secondary thing for me. It's great. I mean, I couldn't have predicted that, and also it wouldn't make sense to me to say to myself, well, I want to make something that has this effect on other people, on viewers. Because you can't really do that. You just sort of have to do something and then see what happens with
it. So it exists sort of in the same way as color field painting, maybe? A sort of, I don't know, it conjures up sort of a Litsky or Morris Louis, these sorts of people that have made vast paintings on that scale, but of course they weren't monochromes as such. But there was, I don't know, there's Eve Klein, who was a Derek Jarman made a film called Just Blue, which was just blue. But of course, he has his commentary, which goes through the whole film.
Sure, and that was
so that's very different.
And that was a very. My understanding is that was a very specific focus because he no longer could actually see the color blue, and it was almost an ode to something that was no longer available to him.
Right.
I hadn't thought about color field painting so much. I really was just thinking about the material itself, you know, this gigantic film stock that's it's beautiful when you look at it. If you've ever seen a frame of conventional 70 millimeter film, you almost don't need to magnify it. You can hold it up and see quite a bit. And it's a roll of it. I mean, on the reel, it weighs quite a bit. It's this very substantial object in itself. Right. And I was really quite interested in exploiting the nature of that.
Right.
And so in terms of what I did to the film itself, it was like, I can work either with a camera or I can work without a camera and work with the printer. And so
the colors are generated by the printer then?
Yes, the colors are generated by the printer. The three valves of the printer, the red, blue, and green valves, have to be they are manipulated by what's called a timing tape, which is basically a thin piece of paper with holes punched in it, rather like a Jacquard loom tape. And that basically is run through a machine that in turn controls the valves. And so it was a very, unlike the color field paintings, it was a kind of hands-off process in a way.
Right.
It was very much about, I wouldn't say totally distancing myself from what ended up on the film itself, but it was not about the decisions that I was making. It was about, you know, what the printer could do, you know, what the film could do, how, you know, we really pushed things quite far in terms of getting really deep blacks and things like that that you normally don't really do in terms of printing.
Yeah.
So it was sort of more about that.
Right. Interestingly, I went to a Beckett play recently at the National Theatre, and it's one of the very few instances where they actually, I don't know how they got permission in a way, to obscure the exit signs, because obviously it required the auditorium to be completely black. You had to have complete darkness. They sealed everything off, including the exit signs. And I think I've only ever been to one film screening, which was by Guy Sherwin, where he also took it upon himself to black out the exit signs. But of course, it goes against health and safety regulations. It's a bit of an issue. But I mean, ideally, I would imagine with such a film like that, you would want almost total darkness in the auditorium. Or
I think that would be helpful, certainly, but I also think that an advantage of 70 millimeter is that it's so large, it's so vast on the screen, and also if the projection is done properly, the color on the screen is so even, like from side to side and top to bottom, that your eye has nothing to hold on to. And this is not to say that you're not going to notice an exit sign in your peripheral vision, but so many things, your eyes are having so much trouble like dealing with what's on the screen, what to look at. You look at the edges, your eye sort of bounces around the screen. And I think my sense has always been that the exit signs maybe are less problematic, unless they're really, really bright, or the theater's smaller. You know, there are, of course, every situation is different.
Okay. All right. So any plans for the film? I mean, can anyone get to see it here in England? Will it be shown anywhere apart from the film festival?
I have not heard of anything else coming up. This print is distributed by the Arsenal in Berlin. And so there is a copy sort of in Europe.
Somewhere. Okay.
And if other institutions or festivals have plans to film it, then I haven't heard yet.
Okay. Well, perhaps we should introduce Morgan now. Thank you both for coming in, by the way. And Morgan, that track we opened with was one of your choices, which we used to enable us to sort of do the changeover in the studio. But I was expecting some sort of soundtrack choices when I sort of suggested maybe you could bring some sounds along, and you gave me this list of surf music, and that was one of them.
Well. Yeah, it was.
It's an interesting track. I mean, I'm not. That was Jack Nietzsche.
Yeah. That's Jack Nietzsche, and the track is "The Lonely Surfer," and I think it was popular in the early '60s. But not all of my choices were surf music. They were all popular music.
Right. But from most of them '60s.
Yeah, most of them from the '60s. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Could I just go back to something that you were talking about with Margaret? I was so charmed by your question as to whether her film was a monochrome or a multichrome. And then I was thinking about this. And at any one instant, I think we can say it's a monochrome. But then in the experience of it, what's revealed over time is that it's a polychrome. Or a multichrome. And when we think about the film as an object, because there is no frame line, it's essentially one continuous field from one end of the film to the other.
Right.
So if you were to unroll it, so to speak, and look at it on a light table, which would be a very long light table because it would be something close to 2,000 feet, it would be a color field painting. It would be an image that would resemble in principle a color field painting, except to the extent that it's based on the proportions of the spectrum, it would be an image of the spectrum, but at the same time in principle, because of the continuous changes within the confines of what I'll call the image, which I mean the image as it would be on the entire length of film, it's something like the model of a color field painting.
Yeah. I mean, some film artists have exhibited their films, haven't they? Paul Sharitz and I think Peter Kubelka.
Yeah.
Never as a continuous strip. I think they've been sandwiched between perspex or something.
Yeah, I think Paul Sharitz did it that way.
Yeah. Is that a possibility for this one, or not? It probably wouldn't work because it would detract from the. You'd have to place them one strip below. You'd have to cut it up, wouldn't you?
Well, I think with both Paul Sharitz and Peter Kubelka, they adhered to the orientation of whatever images were within each frame, and so in that, and they had frame. They have had and have frame lines.
Right.
And so they can sort of like, it's like a bit like a sentence, you know, you stop here and then you start up, the next.
Yeah.
With my film, there wouldn't be any obvious place to sort of cut into the film because there are no frame lines. If it were displayed totally unrolled, which is something I have thought about, it would basically have to be a kind of band sort of on the...
I could go in a circular...
It would have to be
sort of
horizontal in a way instead of vertical strips.
Right. Morgan, your films are also very difficult to see, it has to be said. It's partly by design, but I was reading an interview with Scott MacDonald in is it Critical Cinema Volume 5, I think it was, and you're at the back of that in that book, and there's a, or perhaps it was elsewhere, perhaps it's in your own writings. It's in your own writings where there's a chapter called Missing Boats.
Oh yes, Missing the Boat.
Missing the Boat.
Oh yes,
where you is this fascinating story about how your oeuvre was basically what did they call it? Airbrushed out of the film history. It's your reflections on film history. Basically, you were mentioned by Sidney in his famous structural film essay. But then when they brought out the book, it had been deleted and your name was no longer there. So you were like, it's a bit like one of these sort of Russian photographs where they sort of airbrush somebody out for some reason.
Yes, that's correct. The essay was originally published in Film Culture.
Yeah.
I think in 1969.
Yeah.
And I was mentioned at the very end almost as an afterthought. And then when it was republished in, I think, the Film Culture Reader is where it was first republished, I had disappeared. And there are two questions here. One is the availability of my films in fact, and the other is my presence in what I will call the general understanding of the history of so-called independent film in the United States and abroad. And I have done the expected and conventional thing to make my films available. They're available through the Filmmakers Co-op.
The New York Co-op.
The Filmmakers Co-op in New York, and that's the way you did things when I was starting out, is that that's where you put your films, and so they were available. And then it was sink or swim, and the co-op didn't advertise films. It was up to those interested in seeing them to make contact with the co-op and rent the films that they wanted to rent. But I would like to think that my films are available as any such films can be. But then there's this other question of a larger, let's call it, critical context, and that's another question. But
there was a sort of pantheon, wasn't there? Should we call it a pantheon of filmmakers? I mean, especially on the wave of structural film.
Yeah, I think that can be said. Yeah.
But you seem to have been omitted from that, even though it seems like you were almost like a structural filmmaker par excellence. I mean, you were almost like the essence of structural filmmaking in a way.
Well, thank you for saying that. I've spent many nights, sleepless nights, wondering exactly how it is that these things have happened. But it's not for me to say. I think if I could have a wish about this, it would be that there, at the time and in the subsequent years, my wish would have been that there could be more debate about these things, somewhat on the model of debate within the art world, so that there could be contestation, that there could be critics who championed some work and disdained others, and then another critic who could disagree and present his or her own alternative.
Like a forum.
A forum, or simply debate. So there could be, so to speak, argument in a more or less public way. And with respect to independent film in the U.S., to my understanding, that didn't happen. And I think that that's a loss because a certain history has been accepted as the history, when, as we all know, that history is subject to contestation and to revision, and reputations rise and fall. There are new ways of understanding the sequence of events and how to periodize things, or how to narrativize a succession of events.
It was interesting the way you, in your article, it's in your book of writings.
Yeah.
And you sort of turn it on its head in that you suggest that in a way, it's worked for you that you were never part of that history. You've kind of actually relieved in a way, because it's I can't remember quite how you articulate that. But
well, Well, let's be honest. It's really it's a way to deal with the pain of not being
right.
Not being okay. Among the elect, let's call it. So it's really a form of, it's like saying, well, I'm glad I wasn't invited to the party.
Right.
And but at the same time, I think there's some truth in the attitude that I took in that the moment in which I emerged, if I can put it that way, was in the late 60s. And from the perspective of the present moment, that's many, many years ago. It's antiquity.
Mm.
And
which still resonates all the time.
Wouldn't that be nice? And so not having entered history, so to speak, at that moment, I would like to think that I have escaped the, not oblivion exactly, into which historical figures disappear, but I've escaped being framed in relation to that moment in the same way that perhaps other people whose names we all know, for example, Hollis Frampton and Michael Snow and Peter Kubelka, have become... what's the word? Lost the sentence. I've been spared, so to speak, having been located in relation to a certain history. Even though, if you look at the dates, that's exactly where my work originates.
Right, exactly. But you sort of you've escaped categorization.
Yeah,
perhaps?
I think so.
But
yeah.
There is a sort of post categorization now, isn't there? Where it can now be reviewed. And
wouldn't that be nice?
Well, it seems like your career is. I think you had a major show at Raven Row, and in fact, you're probably doing better, shall we say, in some ways than perhaps other figures from that era.
Well, I think it would be fine with me if it seems so, and I think that what has happened in my case is owed largely to the fact that I've started doing work in media other than in film,
right?
And in particular, I started doing paintings, and I've also done some photography, and this has resulted in my entering the art world,
right?
And so the show at Raven Row was as much about this other side of my practice, this newer side, as it was about the films, although it did include the films.
Yeah.
And but I think that this is something of a parenthesis, but it's important to mention. And that it was Paul Sharitz's great desire to be given a place in the art world, and he did film installations in, I think, the 70s that were shown in art galleries. There was a piece, I can't recall the title, that was shown at a gallery called Bikert.
Okay.
And I think Rosalind Krauss wrote an article about it in Art Forum, and he made these very beautiful drawings that were representations of the installation. But then I think it's as if that was the end of it. But then after his death, that work has come back, and his estate is now represented by Green Naftali. And I believe that work was recreated at a show at Green Naftali within the last few years, as were a lot of his the scores or other preparatory material that he used in making his work. So he, after death, he has come back as someone who left behind things that can be exhibited in an art gallery.
Yeah.
And so,
do you think that it, to sort of backtrack a bit, do you think it sort of worked against you that you were so enamored of the industry?
You mean with respect to the New York school,
to the whole scene, should we say? Which because so much of independent and experimental film was sort of I don't know, what should we say, counterculture. It was about sort of presenting an alternative, working outside of the mainstream, trying to build something literally outside of the norm as presented by the industry. But you seem to have a foot in both camps. You've worked in the industry as an editor. You were a bit player, I think, in Roger Corman's films.
I was a bit player in an independent low budget horror film. I had worked as an editor on a film that a second editor on a film that Roger Corman was the executive producer of. Then later on, I was I had a bit part in a film called Messiah of Evil. And because I was the editor on that, at least I started out as the editor, and so it was done as almost as a joke. But I think my attitude toward the industry is that you can't pretend it's not there, and better to acknowledge it and to use its means, at least its technical means. Such as shooting and sync sound, in order to call into question, shall we say, the devices that such means are ordinarily put to. So I would like to think that even though I've worked with Hollywood equipment, for example, a Mitchell movie camera, and I've shot on a soundstage, that I would like to think that my films, even while acknowledging the industry, are also, I think I can say, critical of it. And they certainly, they make you aware of the very things that commercial motion pictures, above all Hollywood motion pictures, do their absolute level best to keep you from ever thinking about while you watch a film, namely the apparatus, the apparatus in the most general sense, not just the equipment, but also the conventions of cutting that are designed to keep you from ever thinking about the machinery that is bringing you the image, the machinery in the broadest sense, not just the equipment, but the devices and conventions. And so my films are very self-conscious And they use the means of Hollywood to make you conscious, to repeat, to make you conscious and aware of the very things that Hollywood wants you not to think about.
So your films are self-reflexive. Is that a reasonable?
I think I would say so. Yeah.
But I suppose here in England, as far as I know, I saw some of the sort of structural film shows that were presented here. As far as I remember, your films tended not to be included in those. And I think the structural filmmakers here, as sort of personified by, say, Malcolm Le Grais and Peter Guidall, were very much anti-narrative. And it was about sort of, and it has to, you know, the whole, Le Grais and Guidall were both at the time considered Marxist filmmakers. And that was a thing very much in the UK, probably less so maybe in America. But again, it raises this issue of sort of counterculture and working against things. So English structuralism might have been a bit more sort of fundamentalist maybe than...
I love this word, fundamentalist. Well, when I was... when that just implies that American structuralists are just so decadent and so...
Well, there was an argument, wasn't
there?
Yeah,
impure. Yeah, exactly. I was invited to a film festival here in London in 1973 that was organized by David Curtis and Simon Field, an event that I was very glad to be a part of. And I discovered on arriving that there was this raging debate, except it really wasn't a debate. There was this almost violent pamphleteering, let's call it, conducted by the British structuralists against American structural film. And the British structuralists called what they did structuralist materialist. Structural hyphen materialist films. And they held their practice up as the correct practice, and they were dismissive, not just condemning, but dismissive, of these these decadent, not a word they used, American films, with the exception of the work of Hollis Frampton.
Oh.
They made an exception for Hollis.
Hmm.
And I never quite understood the reason, but that doesn't matter. But I, exactly. It was Malcolm DeGrasse and, my goodness me, Peter Godal. I'm just wandering down memory lane here. And
well, I think even Wavelength was condemned for having some sort of narrative element in it, you know, where the sort of person comes in and dies on the studio floor.
Yeah,
I think that's been revised now, but I think there's probably less of a hard line now about it.
Well, have these people abandoned their ideals? I would just hate to think that they're going soft in their in their maturity.
No. Godal and DeGrasse are still sticking to their guns, I think. I don't know if they still call themselves Marxists, but
I remember once. Going to a screening of the films of Malcolm DeGrasse, and he was speaking about his work. And he said, looking at me, that he had no interest in or was unsympathetic to work that was predictable. And I think he had in mind maybe a couple of films, maybe production stills, maybe picture and sound rushes. And I think those two films are predictable at the level of the schematic or the diagrammatic, in that we understand right away what the basic how they're organized, but then within that there are the particular the particularities of what I'll call accident or chance. So but I didn't take it as an occasion to reply to his accusation of making films that were predictable, but my own. So, in attacking predictability, maybe he was attacking narrative, because narrative has predictability, but in the general form. I mean, within the narrative, within the model of Hollywood films, let's say, I mean, all films are the same in principle. All narrative films. It's just a question of the details. And but thank you for leading me to understand this. That his attack on my on me, it was very clear that he looked right at me when he said this, that that his criticizing my work for being predictable was really a way of criticizing it for its narrativity, even though the films are very, very far from narrative in the conventional sense, because those films are organized not on the Aristotelian model of narrative, but rather on the model of succession of equal units that you find in minimal art, for example, which had been hugely important for me. I came of age during the first moments of minimal art, and it was a very important model for me.
Okay. Well, let's moving on from that. I'm intrigued about this project of yours, The Screening Room. This sounds like a fascinating project, which of course I've never seen, probably impossible to see. When was this made?
It was first made in 1968.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. So long ago as that?
Yeah.
But it's an ongoing sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's The Screening Room. Probably requires quite concise description, and it's more like a sort of piece of conceptual art, really, more than a, it's not a film as such, even though it involves film, but it is very site specific.
Oh, sure, but can't it be both? Can't it be conceptual and a film at the same time? Please,
if you say so. Can we? It's quite hard for me to describe, but it can only work in a very specific cinema, and the cinema has to be sort of preordained. You have to choose a cinema somewhere. You then invite an audience to that cinema?
Oh, sure, but should I try describing it?
Please do.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's simplicity itself. It's a tracking shot into the theater where you are sitting watching the film. So it's a film that can be shown in any theater. It's just that you have to make it for that theater.
Right.
And The idea is that you begin some distance away so that when the image comes up, you recognize that you're in the vicinity of where you are, in fact, sitting, and then it's a tracking shot, and then...
So you would be sitting in the cinema.
Yeah.
And on the screen,
yeah,
you see the outside of the cinema.
Well, maybe not quite yet, but for example...
You see the street.
Yeah, something. You see the street. I mean, for example, if it were one of the screening rooms, one of the theaters at the NFT, mm-hmm. we could begin walking across the Hungerford Bridge, although that would be a very, very long film. And then we'll walk across the bridge, then down the stairs and along the embankment.
Right.
And when the film begins, you say, oh, we know where we are. That's the Hungerford Bridge.
Right.
But you think nothing of it. But then as the film continues, it comes closer and closer to where you are, and then it enters the theater. And the theater, in the image that we see on the screen, the theater is exactly as it is when we're watching the film, except that there are no people in it.
Hmm.
And on the screen is the rectangle of white light that we would see if there were no film in the projector. So the film, the camera enters the dark theater, and then there on the screen is the rectangle of white light, and then that's held for a moment, so we see the rectangle of white light within the surrounding blackness, and then there's a gradual zoom into the rectangle of white light, and then the film runs out so that the image of white light, the image of the white light on the screen gives way to the white light on the screen that is still there when the film has run out of the projector.
Right.
It's so simple.
It's simple but complicated. It's simple, but it's quite hard to quite get your head around what happens.
And
so the audience would be in the cinema, and on the screen they see a point of view of a camera entering the cinema, and then what they see on the screen is the whole screen goes white.
Yeah.
And this would obviously have to be filmed before they had entered the cinema.
Mm-hmm.
So it predates there. So
yeah.
It's as you say, it's simple but extremely effective as a way of confronting the audience with where they are. It's like you are here. It's probably the opposite of escapism.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Now, it was one of the first films that I made, and it's been done now a number of times, perhaps, I don't know, 10 or so.
Hmm.
But I don't remember exactly what my thinking was at the time. It just seemed like a good idea.
Hmm.
And it was first shown at a film festival in upstate New York. So I had to drive to Canton, New York, and then shoot the film and then get it developed. And I put a title on it. Oh, this is – I'll get to this in a second. But what I've come to understand since is that what it really does by showing us the space in which we are sitting watching the movie, the film, it gives us – our bodies, or it reminds us that we, in fact, have bodies, which is the very thing that narrative motion pictures are designed to make us forget. So Screening Room is designed to bring attention to us as, or to make us aware of our identity as embodied subjects sitting in the dark.
Well, it occurred to me that it was almost like an out-of-body experience in a way. Because you're looking at an environment on the screen in which you are not present.
Wouldn't it be wonderful? I hadn't ever thought of that. Wouldn't it be wonderful if it could be both? But thank you so much for suggesting that. But something else that I did realize early on was that the film is totally against the universality, let's call it, of the motion picture. We think of a film as something back in the days when all a film was something on celluloid. You put the film in a can, and you put the can in a shipping box, and off it goes, and you can show it anywhere in the world, and it's always the same film. And this is a film where you can't do that. You have to make a specific version for each place that it's shown. So it argues against what I have called the universality of the motion picture image, which manifests itself now with people looking at movies on iPhones.
Hmm.
And of course, at the time I made the film, the future the present we now live in was a future that was absolutely beyond the power of anyone to imagine. And of course, so it cannot, this is important, it cannot be shown on television because, well, for the obvious reason. And this is a little, at the beginning of the film is a title that says, it gives the title of the film and it states the address, the location where it's being shown. It can be shown only there and nowhere else, and it cannot be shown on television. And, of course, one of the things that happened with the arrival of television was that it enabled people to see movies without leaving home. And for many years, narrative movies were the staple of late-night television viewing, like all night. You could watch narrative movies on television all night. And this is a movie that absolutely strikes against that possibility. Mm. I was actually thinking about Margaret's film in this respect when she was talking about the difficulty of showing it. So there are ever fewer 70-millimeter projectors, and so it's...
Well, so both of you, in a way, are sort of involved in this, or have been. I'm not sure what your latest films are like in this respect, but it's interesting. You're both sort of making works or films that are almost impossible. They don't... what's the word? They can't be packaged or can't be sort of absorbed into the system, in a way. They can't be exploited.
Well, I think the system as it exists right this moment, I would agree that they absolutely can't be absorbed into that.
But it's not a sort of... that's not a willful ambition as such. It's like it's almost like a byproduct of what you're trying to do. You come up with this concept, and then as a sidebar to that or something, it turns out that the film is almost impossible to see or is very difficult to
I would say
negotiate.
For me, I would say both yes and no.
Right.
Morgan had mentioned something about screening room basically sort of re-embodying the viewer. And that was something that was an idea that was also very important once I saw what Spectrum Reverse Spectrum looked like. I wasn't thinking about that when I was making it, but once I saw it projected, I realized that was a claim for it, that it allowed the viewer to understand herself in the space with the film, and going through various sort of physiological responses to it. And that's something that you don't get, obviously, on an iPhone or even viewing something, I think, digitally. It would be extremely different. But I think having a film projection is something that also reminds you of the physicality of the film and a lot of the imperfections that come into play.
Yeah.
That get erased basically with digital projections, although not always.
Could I just? I just wanted to mention something. Margaret mentioned before that, or at the beginning, that because there is this enormous field of color without, which is a uniform field, that the viewer is left to decide what to look at within the field. And this is totally different from almost all movies, which are made with a view to controlling exactly where in the frame the viewer looks. And that's one of the ways to think about narrative films in general. It has to do with exactly controlling the audience's relations such that the audience is controlled in relation to the image at every second. That's the ideal. That's one of the ways that movies make you forget that you're actually looking at this event produced by people with an agenda instead of something that just appears before you as if by magic. And Margaret's film, in being a uniform color field, puts the viewer in a position of having to make choices when in fact there's nothing to guide the viewer in how to make those choices. And I think that directs the viewer, that helps direct the viewer's attention back to him or herself as an embodied subject having to make choices, which almost all movies don't do their best to keep you from ever having the freedom to do.
Great. Well, you've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And this week's guests were Margaret Honda and Morgan Fisher. That's perhaps a roundup of where what's going on. You're going to be at the Frieze. Well, Margaret's film was shown at the London Film Festival last night, and who knows when it will be seen again. We'll have to approach the Arsenal to get another screening. Anything else coming up in Europe or Britain or anything? Any exhibits? What are you doing next?
Well, Morgan might have something.
Morgan has got something at the Frieze Art Show, which goes on, I think, until the weekend.
Oh yeah, but I could mention that I have a very short film included in a group program on Saturday night at the London Film Festival. It's in a program of films restored by Mark Toscano at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences in Los Angeles. And he's presenting a program of films that he has restored. And at the end of November, on November 24th, I will have a show with Maureen Paley.
Excellent.
And about which I'm extremely happy. And the show will, in fact, include a film made in 1971, a film that Ken Jacobs has gone out of his way to tell me that he dislikes, for which I'm very grateful for his candor, because he's been a supporter of my work. But then it's always as if there's an asterisk, not as if. In fact, there is, there's this film he doesn't like, and so that's the one that will be shown. And there's also a two-screen video work, which started out on film. And I will be showing new photographs. And Maureen Paley at Frieze has one of these new photographs.
Excellent. So Maureen Paley's gallery is somewhere near Bethnal Green. I forget the street it's on. What is it called?
It's on Herald
Street. Yeah. Thank you. So that's in November, the Maureen Paley Gallery used to be called Interim Art. Now it's just called Maureen Paley.
Maureen Paley. Oh.
And she's at Frieze, and she's got one of your works in that, at the Frieze stand.
Correct.
Excellent. Perhaps we should wind it up there. Maybe we should play another surf track. What do you think?
Well, there's the music that Margaret selected.
I'm afraid I haven't got any of those. I'm sorry, they arrived a little bit late. Was it the Radio Birdman?
Radio Birdman was the one, but that's fine if you couldn't find it.
I'm sorry, we didn't.
Descent into the Maelstrom.
Right. Okay. Why this any particular fascination with surf music, or you just kind of? It's not just surf music, I have to say.
Well, yeah, there's
you've Wonderful Land by the Shadows.
Yeah, I just found out about the Shadows recently.
Right.
And I like that record a lot. I think it's just wonderful.
Okay. Or there's Let's Have a Party.
Yeah.
Who's that? Is that Wanda Jackson?
That's Wanda Jackson.
Yeah.
Who is still with us?
Right.
She lives in Oklahoma City.
Oh, okay.
And she's still active.
Great. Or the other one was Rising Sun or Train to Nowhere. I'll leave the choice to you.
Oh, my gosh. Train to Nowhere was the B-side of Tequila by the Champs.
Right. Is that an instrumental?
It's an instrumental,
the Champs, I know. Wanda Jackson I've heard of. But,
then you should.
Which one should we go?
I think we should play Wanda Jackson.
Okay. So we're going to end.
It's Friday, so it should be Let's Have a Party.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. Okay. So we'll go with Wanda Jackson, Let's Have a Party. Thank you very much to Morgan Fisher and Margaret Honda for coming into Resonance today.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Oh.
The bay. in the middle.